Now I'm joined by a Northside dope who've just written his first book. Bono, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on your programme.
And congratulations. It's no surprise, but I'm sure it's a relief to a lot of people that you can write. It's a fantastic book.
I don't know if I should be insulted by that or complimented. We were talking about the editor, Sonny Mehta, and I very nearly didn't do the book because he apparently, you know, he just said, yeah, he can write. And I thought, well, I always thought I could write. Is that what do you mean? And the person who's explaining this to me said, no, he doesn't think anyone can write. It's his big compliment. He passed away, God bless him, Sonny Mehta, so...
How are the book people next to the rock and roll people? I imagine rock
They're
and roll
wild,
people are pussycats
Brendan.
Next to the book
They're
gang.
They're wild. Yeah. They're just, it's late nights. It's early mornings. Yeah. They've been very kind to me. I mean, you always feel that, you know, if you sort of cross discipline, you jump ship into somebody else's, there's, you know, they can blow a whistle. And... they haven't. And they've, you know, a lot of the literary people seem to be taken to the book. And I'm just hoping that they get out in front of the other crowd, which are coming for me, I'm sure.
Do you reckon, yeah?
I'm sure. But that's okay.
Is that inevitable every time, yeah?
Okay. I'd miss it if it wasn't there.
Yeah, you love it, really. Why write a memoir? Why now?
I had a lot of explaining to do. To myself, to my family, to my friends, tell them what I've been doing with my life, and in the case of the family, with their life, because they permissioned me in the end to be away as an artist or as an activist or whatever you want to call what I've been doing. I wanted to write it down.
Mm. It's interesting you say to yourself, because I was thinking, it could be a dangerous thing to sit down and do a stock take of your life for a fella, is it?
I'm not saying it wasn't.
Yeah.
It definitely changed me, and I don't know if it is for the better, but it certainly sort of stopped me in my tracks. The best bit of it was it allowed me to spend some time quietly on my own. And though I get up early anyway to read and write, whether it's U2 or articles or whatever, letters, I really had to spend a lot of time on my own. And, you know, for a person as noisy as me, I'm sometimes very social, I found I enjoyed my company more than I thought I would, you know.
There's a sense in it that you are at a point where you're reassessing your life. You talk about, you're kind of apprehensive about the third act. You talk about you want to get beyond who you have been and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you have to do some measure of audit, don't you? You and I spoke before about Richard Rohr, you know, the Franciscan friar, and his book Falling Upwards. And he quotes Carl Jung, who says, not only are the things that worked for you and made you successful in the first half of your life not helpful in the second half of your life, they positively can work against you. I mean, they really can get in your way, and that's worth examining if that's true. And so, an example would be talk about somebody else, like a brilliant musician.
Talk about yourself.
Oh, okay. Can I talk about A.J. Malari?
See, this is the thing about the memoir interview.
I know. Well, it's just, you know, if you're a person who, for instance, got some of the most, broke down some doors with your shoulder, and you have you know, but you successfully broke into whatever you were trying to, wherever you were trying to get to. That's not going to work in the second half of your life. And you might just have to look and see if, well, maybe there's the key in the lock. Maybe just turn it, you know. I'm sort of, you know, born a little bit with my fists up metaphorically. And, you know, sometimes just, I walk into RT, can feel myself, you know, I'm just, it's okay. It's like there's nobody jumping out from behind bushes, at least yet.
So you're always looking for a fight, yeah?
No, I'm always ready for a fight. I'm aware that there might be one mentally or, you know, I'm a little bit like that and looking for trouble where maybe there isn't any or going out to look for trouble, which is worse. And, you know, I think at this point, that's just not a successful strategy. I'm trying to put down my hands and I'm coming to this word surrender, which I still don't really understand. I should put a question mark at the end of it, at the end of the title. But, you know, to surrender to, you know, your bandmates or whomever, your maker, your wife, you know, this does not come easy to me.
And stop fighting with yourself as well, I
presume. I was just saying, you know, I do want to make peace with myself, but I'm not ready to make peace with the world as yet.
Oh, good. We'd be glad to hear that.
Thank you.
Listen, you say an interesting thing in here, right? And I know I'm not going to throw back all, you know, select bits of the book at you, but this was interesting. You talk about service, ambition, duty, loyalty, desire to be the best, right? All those things. You wonder now if they were a cover for something else. The desire to be the center of attention, a swollen sense of self. Are you kind of starting to think that Bono has ego issues?
Look, what use would a rock star be without a messianic complex? Do you know what I mean? And
but are you beating yourself up about it?
No. I'm just, you know. I think one thing that's so great about you two is we didn't play the, oh, how do we get here card? Oh, God, I'd rather be anywhere else than being interviewed, you know, or, oh, wow, gosh, what a bummer, we're on Top of the Pops, you know, how did this happen? We never did that. But at the same time, as enjoying being, making a show out of yourself, which is, you know, what I do for a living, it's just worth, you know, asking yourself, where does that come from? Why do you need 25,000 people a night screaming, I love you, to feel like a normal person? That's surely not normal. It was the right time to ask those questions. And then, of course, you discover these incredible sort of insights, you know, which I was not naive to have at an early age, which is things like everyone I needed was right there. You know, Mount Temple Comprehensive, you know, Ali. I meet Ali. I meet the four members of the band. You know, we join each other the same week, you know. I've never said it like that before. That's interesting. We join each other, Ali and I and the band. But you know, other things, other insights, like, you know, as well as everything you need is often right around you if you can just see it. But I also learned to understand that the things that were seemingly wounds were great opportunities opening up as well. So, you know, you lose your mother at an early age, your puberty, lots of people went through much worse. But this is the gift, you know, it becomes a gift for you because you're trying to fill that hole with music, with friendship, you know, with, you know, it's become such a gift to me. A lot of the things that I might have complained about just by writing about it.
Yeah.
I understood that better.
Yeah. Okay. The 25,000 people to make you feel okay. You call it in the book the need to be loved at scale. And I think you put a lot of it down to that need, down to your dad ignored you.
Well, there's two ways, isn't there, to turn a sort of grandstanding stadium singer out of a wee boy. You can tell them everything they do is really worth hearing, and, you know, get them the piano lessons, and, you know, you're, whoa, did you hear that, you know, and, or you can, you know, just ignore them. And that worked much better for me, turns out.
You mentioned then your mother dying when you were at that young stage. It's kind of the casual cruelty of the universe in a way. The way you found out even that Iris had died is kind of quietly devastating, isn't it? Tell me about that.
Yeah. And so it was my mother's father and mother's wedding anniversary and their 50th or 40th. And we'd all been out. It was a big occasion. And we took a room in the pub. I forget the name of it now. But it was a big deal to get a room in the pub. And came home. My grandfather had a brilliant time. He danced with all his daughters. He had a heart attack, fell off the bed, kicked the bucket, literally, in this case. And I wake up the next morning to hear this news, and my mother tells me, and she's the eldest sister, so she goes off to organise everything, including the funeral. I next see her at the funeral, and as he's been, my grandfather, Gags Rankin, has been lowered into the ground, my mother faints, we think, but she had an aneurysm, and that was really the last conversation I had with her was that morning. So yeah, unusual.
And then you go back to the house post your grandfather's funeral and you hear the adults talking, right?
Yeah, that's right. Those whispers, like leaves blowing around. Yes, you know, whispers, Iris, she's passed, Iris. And then I remember my uncle arriving in, and, you know, the kind of wailing, the keening thing they're supposed to be doing in Ireland. And it was a very close family. And I remember the grief of that family, and it made a mark on me for sure. But, you know, they say, was it the Dalai Lama who says, we begin our meditation on life with death. And sounds like a bit of a bummed out thing to say, but, you know, I think it's probably true. And it started with me right there at puberty. And defiance, you know, is the essence of romance. Defiance is what rock and roll music is to me. That's what the joy of U2's music is, the ecstatic. It's life force. And, yeah, we're not misery guts kind of, you know, shoe-staring band. So that rage against the dying of the light, that's at the heart of who we are.
And then you were very angry with your father. And the weird thing is it almost as if you knew something more than you knew all the time?
Yeah. You're referring to my cousin turning out to be my brother.
The phone call you got. But it begins with that phone call, which was so weird, when Norman rang you.
Yeah, in the book, Norman rings and he goes, you won't believe this. I have to tell you something about our family. And I said that our cousin is our brother. And he said, what? And I don't know where it came from, but I must have known that. And it's probably part of my facing off with my father too, that I felt that. And he wasn't really ignoring me, by the way. He was just being an Irish da at that time, but an Irish da with a lot on his mind and his heart and his soul. And And the music, strangely, was the great BAM for him. So I would walk into Cedarwood Road and the stereo and he'd be conducting it with knitting needles, you know, listening to La Traviata. And I didn't know what La Traviata was about. I didn't think he knew what it was about. But we kind of both knew what it was about mm-hmm. at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the opera that was Bob Hewson. Yeah.
And when and why did it emerge that Scott was your brother?
I think Scott suspected something and he just wanted it out in the open. And recently, so
okay.
we discussed this. When I was writing the book, I said, this is your call. And he just wanted it for his kids. And, you know, I loved him before.
Yeah, you guys were very close.
We were actually close. Yeah. And I remember, you know, I remember the grief falling on his mother too when my mother passed. Mm-hmm. And I guess the complexity of that is now, I now understand. And also my father's distractedness. And, you know, I feel very, very close to my father as I wrote him in the book because I started to realise how difficult it was for him in that moment. And I just thought I wasn't there for him, really. And, you know, I wish I could have been. And there's fantastic stuff in Finnegan's out in Dorky in the Sorrento Lounge. You know, we'd meet on a Sunday and he'd always say, you know, the same line, anything strange or startling, which is so Irish, you know. Yeah. And I'd say, like, everything strange or startling. Do you know what I mean? And I'd tell him stories and try to impress him. But he had mischief. And I hope I've painted him with that too, because he did have humour. I mean, he would give me a fiver for Christmas. And when we were number one in America or socks, he had that mischief, that dub mischief. And an attitude, because, and this is one thing I like, really, what I love about Irishness, at least my version of Irishness is, my experience of Irishness is not the obvious. It's my father's working class Catholic from Cowtown, you know, from Oxmanstown Road, who listened to the opera.
Yeah.
His mother was listening to the cricket. You know, he played cricket. He read. You know, he was a clever man. And, so it's just not what you think. Nothing's what you think it is.
Yeah.
And I was saying to somebody the other day, it's like the U2 story. It's like, you know, a Welshman, an Englishman, two Irishmen go into a pub.
Yeah.
You know, and one of them's, you know, only one of them's a proper Catholic Irish. One of them's kind of grows up in the Church of Ireland, me. And is suspicious of all religious traditions and then ends up with this deep faith. You know, it's bizarre.
And I want to come back to some of that. Can we stick with Scott for 1 minute? There's two things I want to ask you about it. One is that Bob, your dad, was alive when you got this news mm-hmm. and you went straight to him.
Yeah.
Which must have been an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, he was, of course he was, he just kind of, he took it very seriously and I asked him, did he love my mother? And he said, yes. And I said, how can that be? And he said, it can. And I felt that was all I had the right to ask of him. And, he was very respectful.
And so it was okay.
Yeah. We worked it through. In a way, it's a great relief and release because now you know what you were looking at, but you didn't know what you were looking at.
Yeah.
And I think, and I loved, Barbara too, and I still do. You know, when my mother passed, she helped, you know, bring me up. You know, an amazing woman, and Scott's brothers, Adam and Michael, I love too. So that we're very close, and actually we're all quite philosophical about it. So we're okay.
Yeah.
But you know, Scott's a very private person, and very high-minded, high ideals. And but so I don't have to be careful because now I'm in public. I don't want to drag him too much into the public sphere, though he did. He did wish to be reported accurately in the book.
Okay, you mentioned four guys walk into a pub there. So you two, one of the great bands of all time, we could say, like given so much joy to so many people. I mean, most people are lucky to have one iconic song if they're lucky, and you guys have dozens of them. Have there been moments where you're able to stop and take in the enormity of that and be really proud of yourself?
Not as many as there should be. In the book, and strangely, the last time we met in Madrid, Brendan, you did an article a few years ago on our band, and it might have been the day before or the day after, but there's a moment on that circular stage in Berlin, where I normally, you know, I thank the audience for giving us a great life. I like to do that every night just because they have. And in this scene in the book, I imagine the audience is just, you know, just sucked out of the room and I'm just left with them. And I thank them for giving me a great life. I thank Edge, Adam and Larry for giving me a great life. And I see them back in Mount Temple Comprehensive in the music room, in the red corridor and the green corridor and the yellow corridor. I do little pictures of them. But as I'm looking at them, I really understand how great they are as musicians. And I needed to give that up more over my life, because I think they've always been pretty good. And you and I talked about this back then, because it was on my mind, it was happening. I'd finally got to a place where I thought, wow, you two's really something. And I felt that I'd caught up with them, you know, as a singer. So I wasn't being down on myself, they're great, I'm not. And I said, no, we're fucking great. This is as good as, you know, power trio gets, and I'm the singer standing in front of them. You know, you've got bass, drums, guitar, and when that can fill, you know, an arena with thunder, and they're at ease with it. They're just playing around. They're having fun with their talent. Yeah, it's about time. It took 40 years, but it's finally like, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, because you do paint a picture in the book of that you always maybe, there were times, certainly, where you were in your breaking down of doors and the constant desire to push it on to the next level, that you might have pushed them a bit too hard at times?
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, spare me whinging rock stars. Do you know what I mean? That's like, it's the gang, you know? It's like, you want to, you know, we have a, you know, you describe Everest, then you climb it. And, okay, there's an element, let's call it, there's an element of, what would you call it? It's not, it's like maybe lying to yourself, because you think, you know, why do you think you can do that? And, but I didn't feel like we were having anyone on. I really felt we had this thing. I really felt we had something. And I just wanted us to take it all the way. But I'm sure it got a bit tiring. I might have used, as Bob Dylan said, I might have used a little too much force. And, you know, it was just, it was a bit over earnest, maybe. Just, you know, it's that old joke, isn't it, about football. You know, it's not, it's said in a Northern English accent, that, you know, it's not a matter of life and death. It's something much more important.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of where we were with our music.
The earnestness reminds me of, there have been various little crises in you two down the years, but one of the early crises, and I mean, it is quite funny, the band nearly split up very early on, kind of because, starting with that, the Edge did not think that this was the best way to do God's work in the world?
The Zen Presbyterian. Yeah, well, I was just back in Mount Temple Comprehensive. I was walking through it, read some stuff out for the 60-year students who wanted to sit through it. And they laughed, and they're very kind to me, actually. So still an amazing progressive campus, you know, it really is. But I found myself in the last week just going, wow, what was it that happened here? Because this is a non-denominational school. Mm. The only thing they wouldn't talk about is religion. But yet something happened and we were all touched by it. And I realised that it was happening not just in Temple Comprehensive, but all over the country. And I think there's a word for it in different traditions: revival, renewal. And you might remember, but charismatic renewal.
I vaguely remember it from when I was a kid. It was in the 70s, a big thing in Ireland.
It was. And I remember cynical and amusing reports in the Irish Times of people jumping for Jesus in the RDS.
Happy clappy is
how we kind of happy clappy. But what was striking about it was at a time of deep sectarian division in our country. It was happening to Protestant and Catholic alike. There were nuns hanging out with Anglican priests and evangelicals. I mean, it was a really, you know, interesting time, and we got caught up in that. And we met some extraordinary people that we learned a lot from. Those sacred texts, which I still hold on to so tightly, were taught brilliantly. There was a couple called the Rose, Chris and Lillian Rowe. But they were like, you know, the world is broken, you know, clearly. And if you want to be part of fixing it, you might have to put down this music thing. And they were at first looked like they accepted us, even though we looked different. And remember, they're hanging out with the Virgin Prunes as well as you too. So you see Gavin Friday with his, you know, his razor head, David Lynch haircut and bover boots and a skirt, googie, looking like a kind of some sort of, you know, Aladdin Sane album cover walking down Grafton Street. And they first seemed to accept us, but then they were like, nah, maybe you need to change. Maybe you need to, if you want to serve God, you know, it wasn't put down your cross and follow me. It was kind of put down your guitars and follow me. And Ed was ready to do it. And then he told me, you know, I went over to see him and he said, I can't do this anymore. I can't just figure this with what I believe anymore. And I went, well, I understand. I've had those questions myself, and then went around to Larry and he was the same. Then went around to Adam and he was like, what? Are you mad? You know, this is the man who's like, you know, all he wants in his life is to play the bass in a rock and roll band. And it's like, four strings are better than six. And he's like, what? Oh, but even Adam, you know, he goes, well, I can't do this on my own, so I'm with you. But then, and this is after our first album's done really well and the US Irish band really happening. This is our second album and a second album's tour. So we have to go and see another God, Paul McGuinness, and tell him. And he's just sitting there and he's like, so let me just get this right. So you've been speaking to God, have you? And we're like, yeah, we have. And God has been telling you what? You no longer to be a band. You can just call God up on a phone and he tells you what to do. Well, it's not exactly like that, Paul. But yes, we have, you know, we're pretty sure God wants us out of the band with this other stuff we want to do with our lives. And he's like, so how do you think God feels about like a legal contract? Because I've signed a legal contract on your behalf to go on tour. And I'm like, okay, maybe we got the God thing wrong, you know. And we go off on that tour. And it was amazing, actually. But even at the end of it, it was still a nagging question for Edge. And probably for all of us. We hadn't resolved it. And I asked Ali to marry me. And I went away to Jamaica. Chris Blackwell, who discovered Bob Marley, gives us Goldeneye, which he owned. It's a rough but beautiful, extraordinary sort of place with no phones and no nothing. But it was amazing for us. Mm. We were broke, but it was like, but it was Bob Marley's vibe. Bob Marley was around. And Edge started to write Sunday Bloody Sunday. And he was trying to figure out a way of making the music matter to the exterior world rather than just the interior life. When I hear Sunday Bloody Sunday now, and I'm so grateful that he took me there, took us there.
Yeah.
But I also hear Bob Marley. I can hear, you know, broken bottles on the children's feet, bodies screwing across dead end street. How long? How long? It's, if yeah, you think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then to sort of tie this up, and not in a bow, but not in a knot either, Chris Blackwell, when he gets delivered this album called October, which is full of these sort of ecstatic religious art songs, everyone else is panicking. This, but he's like, no, you know, Bob Marley was, of course, you know, he's very posh. And he said, no, this is, it's not Rastafarianism, but, you know, it's, these are big questions. And, you know, Bob wrote about, you know, God and women and the world outside and protest songs. They're all the same to him. Yeah. And so, but that gave us back our band.
Yeah. People will be surprised, I think. People know you're a man of faith, but I think they'd be surprised reading the book just how important Jesus is in your life. I mean, it's definitely the only rock memoir I've ever read that includes the letter from St. Paul to the Corinthians at length.
It's a Eugene Peterson message translation, by the way. Just okay. If you're a little okay. Tired of it yeah. At weddings and
okay.
Funerals.
Okay. So, and it is, scripture is, the Bible is your Bible, essentially. That's where your
Well, it's a great ode from. To love. You know, I mean, look, you know, Beatles wrote that. It was their course. Subject was love, you know. Yeah, I remember we have these, maybe this is too long for your program, but before we go on stage, you know, we should be just, I go into Noel Gallagher when he's having a great time. It was the same with the Oasis. They're like, they're having a laugh, their friends are around, and somebody goes, yep, Tom, and they walk on stage to get ready to go on stage for you too. It's like, oh my God. You know, it's a whole thing. And it's a prayerful thing. And we make sure that we lock the doors and nobody can get in, you know. And it's quiet. And Dennis Sheehan, God rest his soul, he's our tour manager, took, you know, he'd explain to people, they're just having a quiet time. We never want to do the public prayer, you know, that sort of, you know, let everyone see you do all that.
Yeah.
And so it's live eight. Not Live Aid, but Live 8, 20 years ago today, Sgt. Pepper, Paul McCartney opens Live 8 in London, and we're the band. You two are playing the band. So he's with us, but we're having our moment getting ready to go on, and he is, we didn't know it was him knocking at the door, trying to get in, but Dennis is saying, I'm sorry. You know, so we finish our prayers, and I go, "Who was that?" And he said, "It was actually Sir Paul." But he's gone now. And I said, "Oh God, no!" I ran out, and I see, you know, he's like Mozart, he's like Johann Sebastian Bach, for God's sake, and he's walking across the back, and I run up and I go, "Paul, I'm so sorry, just coming over, having a, you know, I was just trying to say, like, you know, we're all going on together." And I said, look, we have this moment where with prayers, you know, and I don't want, it sounds excruciating. I'm really, he goes, listen, I would have loved to be part of your prayers. I would love that. And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. We'll ask, you know, anytime. I'll tell Dennis. And, and he goes, what about now? We should be praying now. So at this point, Larry and Edge and Adam are walking over. We're behind stage. Everyone can see us. I'm going, well, we'd have to go, you know. And he goes, now? Are we doing it now or not? And we bow our heads in front of all the kind of, you know, industry people and all this. Yeah. And I'm feeling like one of those country acts or, you know, I'm like, oh. And we bow our heads. And I can't remember exactly the prayer. He prayed it. But it was something like, you know, make us instruments of your peace.
Yeah.
And I remember it. And I remember thinking, of course the Beatles. Of course this is their power of love. All you need is love. And, you know, love in the abstract is, you know, can become concrete and it can change lives and change the course of history, you know, the Vietnam War, you know, love and peace and all that. But love to me is best expressed in a child born in dung and straw, you know. And I see not just the poetic genius of this, utter fragility. It's not New Age, my faith. Yeah, it's
old
not
school.
It's in that sense.
Yeah.
Although all the kids were not baptized into any one religion, they were baptized Christians, and that was very deliberate. But the Judeo-Christian framework, he said seriously, it's given us a lot. And I wonder, as people now in this country crushed by, you know, what's happened in the churches and, you know, in some parts of the geography of this country, the church has been filled with hate and bile. Some part you've paedophile, you know, priests, and some part you've had, you know, real abuses of faith. And to spiritually abuse somebody is the worst of all because they can't get back their faith. And I feel like the country's been spiritually abused in a way. And it's a shame because it is a beautiful thing to walk into a mass or a synagogue. I even, you know, I go to Seder or Passover. I love these symbols, this ritual, this, you know, this dance, this ceremony. I'm more attracted to it now than I thought I could ever be. And I'm still not good at it and not practicing in, well, I'm practicing, but I'm not practicing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Do you say in the book, you're a follower of Jesus, but you can't keep up?
I just can't keep up. That's why I can't find out how to put the badge on, because people are going to point at me going, ha ha, look at you.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to make that standard.
Did faith help you lead a relatively normal life and help you avoid the excesses of rock and roll and that?
I don't think I avoided the excesses of rock and roll. I think faith has helped me not be destroyed by my own, you know, ego. Although it's an open question for many, and maybe for my missus and my kids. But, you know, yeah, it's a plumb line that you measure yourself by, I suppose. And in my case, it's not great. You know, it's like somebody said, you know, the sacred texts are like a reflective pool, and it's not narcissism, because you might see yourself as you are, and that's not always admiring. You know, you feel loved, and you should feel loved.
Okay.
But by your maker, and you should not feel accused. That's not how love works. And I'm working at this, but you know, if you have a daily practice, you should be reminded just how much you're loved by God, and no one else can judge you, whoever you are, your sexuality, your whatever you've been through. You know, come as you are, and you won't find, you know. I mean, I just wonder if Jesus would be hanging out with half the people that we call, you know, religious figures. It would be boring for him.
You say you didn't avoid the excesses of rock and roll. You said after your friend Michael Hutchins' death, you say that you kind of thought about it a bit and thought, are we getting a bit too good at living the good life? Was there a bit of self-destructiveness in the air around then?
I mean, you know, I just think, you know, what do they say? You know, the Irish, our relationship with alcohol is like the America's relationship with guns.
Yeah.
Like, what problem? So, yeah, you know, there's, you know, I mean, I like to have a good time. I think I am a good time. Yeah. But, you know, you can take that so far. You know, you don't want to be, you know, I loved bumping into you around town and, you know, in my 30s and it's great. But there is, you know, there's a point where you just, where suddenly you're not playing with fire. The fire is playing with you. And I watched that with Michael Hutchence, who was just the most perfect pop star. Like the nearest I will get to meet, like, say, Mark Bolan of T-Rex. It was effortless for him. His beautiful voice and his lisp. You know, he had this lisp which girls just couldn't.
Yeah.
Just couldn't get past. It's just, okay, so he's so amazing. And a kind of pockmarked face that didn't come up in photographs. And he, you know, it was just brilliant. And yeah, and suddenly then, you know, he disappeared into this hole. And he met somebody who utterly adored him, you know, Paula. It was very hard because she also loved Bob Geldof. And we were in the middle of that. That was a hard moment. It was all just getting a little messy. We're just not
for
that.
It was very
that.
Sad when they asked you and Ali to be a godparent to the child and you had to say, I'm sorry, we can't do this.
Well, it was a mistake. I deeply regret that. But there was a young child involved and we just didn't want to feel whilst they were on this very self-destructive path that we could just be there going, yeah, everything's fine. Mm. You know, wow, yeah, let's be the godparents.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Okay, we'll take a break and we'll be back in a minute with more from Bono. So are you making music at the moment?
Yeah, unreasonable guitar music.
Yeah?
That's where we're at. We've lots of songs put aside, some of which will emerge at the right time. But the only thing The Edge wants to talk about right now is unreasonable guitar music. And he's just really fed up with the pop charts. And so, yeah, that's U2's.
So when might we see music?
I mean, you'll have to hurry up, The Edge. He'd still be mixing our first album. That's the only thing.
So is this stuff finished and ready to be?
No, we're writing these songs. We're demoing them.
Okay.
And but we've different albums. We have this very reflective album called Songs of Ascent. It's nearly finished. But it's just not right to put it out.
That's been going, like, when did you first mention that?
It's 10 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
one of those.
So that's there.
It's kind of almost, I mean, I would say it's 70% there.
Okay.
But it's just not right for us. We only want to put out music when we're ready to take the music to our audience live. It's just, we're not ready.
Will that be Vegas next year? Is that?
I hope it'll be ready. But I can't announce Vegas. You'd have to shoot me. But if it happens, I can promise you it won't be like anything you've ever seen in Las Vegas or anywhere ever.
Oh, I can well imagine.
It is the most extraordinary. If it comes off,
yeah,
it's grand madness by 100. And it will center around Acting Baby, which we feel we need to really honour.
Great.
But it will also, you know, we have to have these new songs out, don't we?
Okay. So if there was to be a residency, there are possibilities in that you don't
there's
have
no place,
a tour,
no,
isn't there?
There's no place yet.
Build it and you will come.
But if we can build one for our audience and but it'll be... Yeah, it has to, for us to go, we have to really, it'd have to be like no one's ever gone before. So does that sound very bit Star Trek?
Amazing.
Part Star Trek, part Travelling Salesman.
Yeah, that's both sides. Come here.
I've another one here. Yeah. I've got some books. Would you like some books?
In 2016, you start the book with this. You had an 8-hour heart operation. Does that change everything?
It's waking up is great.
Yeah.
I don't just mean from the surgery. I mean, just mean in general, I'm finding waking up is great. I didn't want to talk about it because I didn't want to be the kind of person who talks about their surgeries. I just didn't want that. But again, in Madrid, you and I kind of talked around it. Mm. And it did set off Songs of Experience, which is a really special set of songs. And they now you'll understand them a bit better if that's on the cards. But I've had a few elbows, you know, the divine elbow in the ribs over the years. You know, the odd hint that maybe, you know, I would have to think about my life differently. And that was the final, you know.
Okay. So what does that involve? Healthy living?
I'll steady on. I'm not going for a swim every morning.
Okay. If we loop back around to where we started, you mentioned about having to explain things to your family and the being away a lot and everything. You say a funny thing about it. You say the kids missed out, Ali missed out, and you say I missed out, as in you missed out as well. And in a weird way, it sounded like a kind of a businessman from South County Dublin who'd been away on business a lot. There was something very kind of
very
normal about it, but
very hurtful.
So you were away too much, yeah?
Businessmen from South County Dublin have feelings too, Brendan. And I missed out. But remember, you two didn't tour a lot. You know, we did in big, you know, we do big tours and then come home. So when I was home, I was really home. And I could drop the kids to school and I'd be around for them more than most busy fathers or mothers. But that said, I think it got very intense when the One Campaign stuff and dropped the debt and then all of that, because then I was away twice.
Yeah.
I two jobs. And, you know, there's Ali cover for me to, you know, I mean, I'm not saying they're well-adjusted kids. Let's not get carried. But they're amazing and they're at home with who they are.
Yeah.
And that's Ireland. It's Ali. But I played a role. I will give myself, you know, I give myself that. I did play. I wasn't an absent father.
Yeah. Were they more to about the book? And there's little bits about them here and there in it and stuff. And far too much being told about their dad and everything. Were they like, oh, Christ, Dad, like, we've put up with a lot with this?
Yeah. Yeah. After knocking on the head after this. giving it to Ali was a moment, and I was telling someone she'd one thing she wanted to take out of the book, that was all, and we were mostly spellings. But yeah, that was Ali. She was, it is a love song to her, I think.
Yeah. Come here, did she give you anything else when she gave you back the book apart from the spellings? Would she give you like, that's nice, or thank you so much? No.
Oh, no.
Yeah. You're still chasing her after all these years, yeah?
Yeah, even her kids are chasing her.
Yeah.
I mean, she's not just a mystery to me. There's a lot to discover still. And, I have to work at getting her attention. But there were, you know, times I know when she felt she didn't have mine. And there were times when I was home, when I didn't feel like I was home.
Yeah. Rock and roll is hard on a marriage, is it?
I don't know. I think boredom's probably harder on a marriage. I don't think it's the obvious that take people away from each other. I don't think so. It's like, really, you know, if you fall in love with the, you know, the waitress in the in the bar, it's not really going to be the waitress's fault, you know. There's something missing there,
yeah.
And you either fix that or anything, but it's not the obvious. Some, you know, staying at home and sort of hiding from the world is not going to save a relationship.
Yeah. You have mullet regret.
Dear Frankie, mullet. Do I have?
Yeah, you have mullet regret about Live Aid.
I had a bad hair life and not just a bad hair day. Our son John is wearing a mullet at the moment.
They're back, yeah.
And I'm like, really? And yeah, a man should not look like his hair has been ironed. And yeah, it was fun. But Live Aid, what a thing that was, you know? It was amazing. Yeah, but yeah. And all I should be thinking of was all the people who, you know, whose lives were transformed and the culture that transforming the lives. And I look at it and I'm going, whoa, that is bad. And I suppose that's just the other side of, of me.
You've a good line. I don't know. Is it yours? Business at the front, party at the back.
That's not my line. That's an excuse. I did not know I had a mullet. I thought I was looking like David Bowie. Like that's the problem. Is a mullet is a kind of bargain basement.
Bargain basement Bowie.
That's it. No, I got it completely wrong.
Listen, Bono, thank you so much. The book is called Surrender, 40 Songs, One Story. It's published by Penguin. Bono, thank you very much.